This week we're going to continue what we started last week, which is the discussion of Christianity and the class struggle. All right, there's some stuff that we did not get to, and I think it's pretty important. I'm going to talk about an issue biblically. The reason for bringing it up is so that we can see how the issue was mishandled, I think, by Christians in the past, and it will better enable us to understand the situation we're living in now. All right? The subject I'm talking about, I'm not bringing up advocating a return to it. You'll understand what I'm talking about in a minute. I am talking about a shift of mentality, I'm not advocating one kind of system over another kind of system. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be looking at the subject of slavery, right? We're going to be looking at the subject of slavery, and we are going to talk about it in terms of the class struggle and in terms of people who are well off and obviously people who are not well off, and what does Christianity have to say to those who are doing very well and those who are not doing very well in a particular system, all right? We're going to look at the Bible's response to this situation. Then we can talk about what a worldly or a human response to it is, and we'll see how different they are. Okay? First, I don't think there would be any debate in asserting that slavery is a result of sin. Okay? Slavery exists in the world, and it is a result of sin. It is not the kind of thing that God would have designed had Adam and Eve not sinned. Slavery, the bondage of one person to another, is not part of God's perfect plan. It is a result of man's rebellion. But so are clothes. All right. When we say that certain things are the result of sin, we are not saying that those things themselves are sin. Okay? Now, secondly, because slavery is the result of sin, you cannot remove slavery unless you remove sin. We have not removed sin from the world. Consequently, we have not removed slavery. We have only changed the institution that it shows up in. In other words, we've shifted it from one kind of slavery to another kind of slavery. Our Constitution prohibits slavery except in certain cases. In other words, when someone's sent to the penitentiary, they are enslaved. Right, that's an enslavement that is against the person's will. Sometimes they're required to work against their will. It's a slavery that is not inherently immoral, but it is the result of something that is immoral. It is the result of sin in the world. Okay, now slavery will exist as long as you have fools. All right, and by fool, I'm not using it in the modern English sense of dummy. I'm using fool in the proverbial sense, in the sense of the book of Proverbs, the person who is morally dense, morally obtuse, and just doesn't get these concepts. As long as you have folly, as long as you have fools, you will have slavery. Right? In Proverbs it says, the borrower becomes the lender's slave. What sort of person earns $1,000 a month and lives off of $1,500 a month? A fool. What does a fool rapidly become? A slave to his creditor. Okay, when you have stupidity, when you have folly, when you have moral denseness, slavery will follow. It could be slavery to a creditor. It could be slavery to certain circumstances like poverty. But everybody who's poor is in a position where they are under someone else's control. Okay, now the Bible teaches that poverty comes from different sources. Sometimes poverty comes from oppression. Sometimes poverty comes from drunkenness and gluttony, it says in Proverbs. Sometimes it comes from laziness. It comes from different sources. But a poor person, in order to live, is dependent on others to live, and his poverty is a type of slavery. Okay? Now, consequently, unless we usher in the millennium, unless we usher in a utopia, we are not going to eliminate slavery. We're just not going to do it. So what we have to do is, as Christians, say, what do we do about this fact of life? What we do is we keep the slavery that must exist within certain bounds, right, within certain limitations. Okay? Now, I'm going to address the subject of pure institutional slavery. I'm not talking about the We have slavery today in the United States, but it's, like I've mentioned, the results of people getting over their head and finances, that sort of thing. But someone who is born the property of another. I'm going to talk about pure institutional slavery. First, at least in America, slavery was not the ownership of one person by another. Okay? The slave master did not own the slave. What the slave master owned was the slave's labor without the slave's consent. There was no claim made that the slave owner owned the slave's soul and mind and relationship with God. He just owned his labor. Okay? Now, but he owned the slave's labor against the slave's will. The slave did not have a choice in it. Now, before we approach, what we will do is, I think we're all most familiar with slaveries that existed in this country. So what we're going to do is give a backdrop of a scriptural teaching, and then we're going to approach this problem and see how the Christian approach to a class differentiation is 180 degrees out from a humanistic approach to a class differentiation. All right, first, Hebrew slavery, slavery that was tolerated in the Old Testament and regulated by the law of Moses, was closer to a glorified indentured servanthood. Okay? A Hebrew could not make himself, a Hebrew could sell himself into indentured servanthood for a period of time, but he had to be released periodically. They were allowed to hold slaves from foreign nations, slaves taken in war. Slavery did exist, but was severely regulated by the law of Moses, the law of God. There were certain boundaries. Slaves had certain rights. If you mistreated a slave in a certain way, you had to let them go free. So the slaves had legal standing in society as persons. Right? The slaves under the Mosaic law had legal standing in the society as persons. They were protected in their position just as the master was protected in his. So Hebrew slavery is something that was tolerated and regulated in the scriptures. All right, there was a law that a runaway slave that came to you, it was not a matter of a runaway slave from your next door neighbor coming over to you, but a slave from one of the pagan nations, I think is what it's referring to, comes to you, they were forbidden to return him. The presumption being that a slave that came from one of these nations did not have the protection that a slave had under the law of Moses. All right? Now, in the New Testament, the teaching we have on slavery is different than the teaching we have in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, we have a theocracy, a nation that is created by God, and the laws are created by God, and then he regulates what happens both spiritually and politically in that nation. In the New Testament, the Christians were not in control of the Roman Empire. They just weren't. And Christianity spread out through this empire, and pretty soon you had people getting converted. And when you had people getting converted, you had slave owners getting converted and slaves getting converted. Now, the legal status of the slave in the Roman Empire was zip zero. He had no legal protection at all. I think the name in Latin is pater familias. I may be wrong about that. But the Roman head of the household, the father, the head of the household, had the right of capital punishment for anybody in his household. That included, his kids and his wife and everybody. But, how much more a slave? He was the law in that household. So you have Christianity spread into the Roman Empire where you had millions of slaves. I think there was one estimate in the city of Athens there were more slaves than freemen. I'm not sure about that. But there were millions of slaves in the Roman Empire at the time Christianity spread. Now, these slaves had they had a bad lot, to put it mildly. Things were rough on them. They were oppressed. They were mistreated and mistreated as a class. Okay? What does God tell his people to do in this situation? All right, if you're free, don't seek to be a slave. If you're a slave, don't seek to be free. That's in Corinthians. Also in Corinthians, he says, if you have an opportunity for freedom, take it. Freedom is better than slavery, but don't break your neck, trying to get out of your condition of servitude. That's in Corinthians. Repeatedly in Ephesians and in Colossians, he says, Slaves, obey your masters with respect. Masters, let's turn to Colossians just for a sample of this. It comes up again and again and again. Colossians 3:22. Slaves, obey your earthly masters in everything, and do it not only when their eye is on you and to win their favor, but with sincerity of heart and reverence for the Lord. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart, as working for the Lord, not for men, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It is the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for his wrong, and there is no favoritism. Masters, provide your slaves with what is right and fair, because you know that you also have a master in heaven. We have the institution of slavery that exists in the Roman Empire. That institution, you've got the fact of slavery, and you also have beside it the fact that slaves are mistreated. Right? The fact of slavery and slaves are mistreated within this institution. Which does the New Testament attack? The mistreatment. Okay? Now, does the New Testament ever, at any point, hint that slavery is in and of itself a sin? Okay? Nowhere. Does it vigorously attack masters who abuse their slaves? Yes. And slaves who won't work for their masters. It deals with it from both ends. Right? It always attacks the abuse. Okay? And says if you're going to be a Christian, you can be a Christian and be a communicating member of the Christian church and be a slave holder, provided that you provide your slaves with what is right and fair. You treat them equitably, and remembering that God doesn't really care all that much about these distinctions down here on earth. You've got a master in heaven. You're not the top dog. All right? Now, let's look at a couple of other places just to reinforce the point. Look at Timothy. 1 Timothy 6. All who are under the yoke of slavery should consider the masters worthy of full respect, so that God's name and our teaching may not be slandered. Those who have believing masters are not to show less respect for them because they are brothers. Instead, they are to serve them even better because those who benefit from their service are believers and dear to them. These are the things you are to teach and urge on them. Okay? Now, one of the things that's interesting is that there's a division here, in your English Bibles, but I think that this next section is a continuation. If anyone teaches false doctrine and does not agree to the sound instruction of our Lord Jesus Christ and godly teaching, I think he's just following out what he's just said. He is conceited and understands nothing. He has an unhealthy interest in controversies and arguments that result in envy, quarreling, malicious talk, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of corrupt mind who've been robbed of the truth and who think that godliness is a means to financial gain. This is a description of abolitionism. Okay? Those who say, no, you can't just attack the abuse. You have to attack the very institution. The person who denies this, the person who says, if you have a Christian master, he's in sin. Period. What did Paul just tell you to do? If you have a Christian master, you say, my master is dear to me. He's a brother. I'm going to work all the harder because he's a brother. All right? Now, that is the antithesis of the attitude that you had in abolitionism in our country a little over 100 years ago. It's just the absolute antithesis.
But how many masters who had slaves were there really who treated their slaves?
Okay.
They should be treated.
That's a good question, but there's two responses. One, it doesn't matter. Okay. That's the first thing. If the master is not a Christian, you work hard for him, back in Colossians, as to the Lord, not as a man pleaser, but as though you're doing the service for the Lord. Doesn't mention in Colossians whether he's a believer or not. All right, so you work hard for your master as unto the Lord, regardless if you know the master's spiritual state, and if the master's a believer, all the more, because he's a brother. Okay, so the first thing is it doesn't matter. The Bible attacks abuse and oppression. Right, and attacks it vigorously. It also attacks it effectively. All right. Now, what is going to happen to a grumpy master, all right, a non-believer, arrogant, greedy, all these things, when all of a sudden his slave is converted and becomes the most efficient slave he'd ever had? All right, working his heart out. What's going to happen? What happened to you? All right. Same thing, incidentally, that happens to non-Christian husbands whose wives are converted. They're instructed in Peter to win their husbands without a word, okay, by the reverent and chaste behavior. Now that got, now suppose he's a crummy husband. All the more reason to win him without a word, by your reverent and chaste behavior. All right? What do ungodly people do when you respond with ungodliness? You know, if your master mistreats you, and so you start goofing off and stealing and, you know, doing all these things, is he going to let up? No, he's going to pour on, and it gets worse and worse and worse. All right? Now, God's way of attacking this sort of thing is not man's way of attacking it. Right? Now, God's way of attacking it is to recognize the legitimacy of the institution in a fallen world and to not tolerate the abuse. Now, before I go any further, there are several things that you have to realize. One is that the textbooks that you learned about the Civil War in were written as the result of one side having won the war. If the other side had won the war, the textbooks would have been different. All right, you've got to realize that revisionist history works both ways. So you've got to take everything you learn with a grain of salt. Now, but as a Christian, you know, just a priori, that because man is sinful and fallen, no matter what institution you have, you're going to have abuses of it. People are corrupt, right? Now, suppose you respond, but, you know, families were, in the South, families were separated, you know, the wife and the husband were sold different places, and slaves were mistreated and beaten and killed, and some of the women were used sexually, and, you know, what about all this? Okay? The first thing you do is say, okay, first, let's grant everything you say. How do we attack this problem scripturally? All right? That's the first thing. Grant everything you say. How do we attack it scripturally? Secondly, the argument is not valid. Suppose I wanted to argue, do you think I could fill a book this thick with nothing but case history after case history of case history where wives have been beaten up by their husbands? Okay, do you think I could just give you horror story after horror story? Mm-hmm. Think I could do that? Okay. Do you think I could do that and have every case history be accurately researched and true? Yeah. Okay. Does it follow from that the institution of marriage is to be abolished? Mm-hmm. All right. Do you see what we're saying? Mm-hmm. The person who says abuse occurs in marriage, therefore marriage is invalid, or child abuse occurs, therefore parenting is not to be tolerated, that just doesn't follow. You attack the abuse, you don't attack the institution. Okay? Now, if you attack the abuse so effectively that the institution withers or is radically modified, fine. All right? Marriage was ordained by God before the fall, right? And I think it was therefore different in kind than slavery, which is a result of the fall. But the point remains that you've got to attack it. You have to attack what was wrong, and you have to attack it scripturally. Okay? Now, let me first, I want you to understand that what I am saying is not so much a defense of the South as it is an attack on the North. Right? All right? I believe abolitionism, as abolitionism was expressed in the United States, was an awful, awful sin. Abolitionism was a manifestation of the spirit of envy. It was just abolitionism, as a rule, general rule, was evil. Okay? Yeah, envious of the institution, envious of the class differences, and that's wrong. It's wrong for you to be benefiting by his labor, and, you know, that whole mentality was just anti-scriptural and evil. Okay? Now, I also believe that there were many, many evil slave holders, all right, in the South. But I also believe that there were godly slave holders in the South. And I mean devout, godly Christian men who were involved in leading their slaves to Christ, and, you know, who were doing the right thing by them. And they were not inherently in sin because of what they were doing. Okay? You are in... let's say you've got a lot of money, you are in Charleston at the slave market, and you're not there to buy a slave, but you see a family that is in the process of being separated. Okay? Do you have the right to, could you bid on them and buy the whole family in order to keep them together? and not be in sin? Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. You're not in sin because of what you're doing. Now, if you take them home and mistreat them all, you're in sin. It's that simple, right? The institution itself can be participated in without sin. Now, on that issue, the Southerners, who were Christians, had the best of the scriptural argument. They had the scriptures with them cold, right? Now, the thing that astonishes me, and it just really astonishes me, is the New Testament teaches, in place after place after place, what the relationship of a slave to a master ought to be, and what the relationship of a master to a slave ought to be. It's over and over. And it was teaching it in the Roman context, which was far worse than what we had in the South a little over 100 years ago. Roman slavery was far worse than slavery in the United States. Okay? Now, what amazes me is people in the name of God did something that God had no desire for them to do. Now, I'll go a step further. One of the reasons we have, to this day, racial animosity and racial hatred is because of the damage done by the way the problems in the South were attacked. In other words, the racial animosity is the result not of the slavery, but of the abolitionism. I'll give you an illustration of that. Well, let me just give you just a few facts. Again, this is not a defense of one side against another. It is simply a recognition that you could be in the South and not be in sin. You could be a slave holder and not be in sin. You could, if I were a pastor of a church there, I wouldn't have, if someone said, yes, I'm a slaveholder, I wouldn't say, well, you can't join the church. I would ask how you treat them. I would ask, what do you do for them? But just being a slaveholder is not a sinful thing.
What about fighting in the war, civil war?
What about it?
Well, if you're a slaveholder, you're not doing anything wrong, but the North's attacking you, you fight against
them. Okay, this is... Okay, what I would boil it down to, there's a lot of issues, constitutional issues and everything else, but not to make a big production out of it. If I'd been alive at that time, I think I would have fought for the South. All right, that's my reaction. Now, I also would have fought in the South for more legal protections for slaves along the lines of what Moses guaranteed. But one of the things that's astonishing is that many of those protections, for example, there was no protection against separating families. I think there should have been a legal protection keeping slave families from being separated. But you did have, protected by law, was slaves in the South had their Sabbath protected by law. In other words, they were by law required to give the slaves one day off a week to rest. The slaves had the right to take their master into court if there was believed to be abuse. The state of Virginia, 19 times, I think it was 19, a number of times, 19 times before the Revolution, tried to get the British Empire to abolish the slave trade. They were opposed to the slave trade. I read a book by a fellow named R.L. Dabney. It was called A Defense of Virginia in the South. He was Stonewall Jackson's chaplain, and he was a godly man. His chapter on the slave trade begins, "This iniquitous traffic." Right? He's a Virginian who was vehemently opposed to the slave trade. He hated it. Right? He cites how many slaves were thrown overboard and mistreated and stuff in the transit. He was a slaveholder, a Christian, defending the South, and said that the slave trade was evil and a violation of Scripture because of how it treated these people for whom Christ died. Right? Now, and then he points out, and this is the sort of thing that's astonishing, is that the South tried to interrupt and prohibit the slave trade. Virginia or the South, I forget which, tried to put in the Declaration of Independence one of their complaints against the king, all the complaints that they registered against the king. One of the complaints the South wanted to register is that the king wouldn't let them regulate the slave trade. All right? Now, here's the problem. The slave trade was run by Britain, okay, and New England. The New Englanders had all the ships. They had the slavers. The British Empire had all the slave ships. The South didn't have any merchant navy to speak of. Right? They didn't have slave ships. They repeatedly tried to stop by law slaves from being dropped off there, they were prohibited from doing that, and then they wind up with, against their will, millions of people. All right, now what do you do? Do you see what I mean? You've got this society and these people who are taken forcibly and wrongly out of their homes in Africa, who are basically still savages, are plopped down in the middle of your society. What do you do with them? What's the godly thing to do? Dabney's answer was, you put them to work and treat them right, and you educate them. You know, you teach them the value of work, you teach them the value of discipline, you educate them, you bring them up, you lead them to Christ. Did you know that in the South, before the Civil War, there was no integration? Blacks and whites, everybody went to the same, there was no segregation. Blacks and whites, everybody went to the same church. All right, the master and all his slaves would go, and the slaves would be full members of the same church that the master was the member of. Now, all of this is not to deny that slaves were grossly mistreated in the South. All right, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is there's nothing inherently immoral about one person owning another person's labor. Right, there's nothing inherently immoral about it. It depends on how you treat them. Okay, now, if the New Testament means what the New Testament means, it means that a master can be a master and a practicing Christian in full fellowship with the Apostle Paul and still own the labor of another against that other's will. Because that's what slavery is. What is the book of Philemon all about? Okay, Onesimus, Philemon's the master. Onesimus was a runaway slave, apparently led to the Lord by Paul in Rome. Paul leads Onesimus to the Lord, but he knew Philemon back in Asia Minor and writes him a letter, said, I didn't want to keep your property without your permission. Basically, I'm returning Onesimus to you. He was a dear service to me, but, you know, and this gracious letter, and Paul and Philemon are in full fellowship, and Onesimus is now a brother, and he says, receive him back as a brother. You know, before he was useless to you, now he's useful in two ways. And when you look at that, and you look at the attitude of envy that says, if someone else is benefiting by the labor of someone else, it is inherently sinful, and it is not. Okay? Now, when it says in James chapter 5 that the rich people who oppress the laborers by failing to pay them wages, that is oppression because it's a violation of the duties of a master. Or it's the violation in that case of the duties of an employer. One of the duties of an employer is, if you contract your work out, you then do what you say you're going to do. If you don't do it, you're in sin. All right? Let's turn back to Proverbs to look at a few interesting... Okay, if you make a contract with a free laborer, you should pay what you agreed to. If you have a slave, the contract, you don't have to pay him a certain wage, but what you have to do is you have to pay room and board and clothes, and you have to provide for basic needs.
Treat him humanely.
You treat him humanely. Treat him like a Christian ought to treat another person. All right? It's just that simple. Now, in Proverbs, I was just reading this earlier. Okay, look at Proverbs 29:7. Okay, 29:7 says, the righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. The righteous care about justice for the poor, but the wicked have no such concern. Look down at verse 14. If a king judges the poor with fairness, his throne will always be secure. If a king judges the poor with fairness, his throne will always be secure. Now, what does it mean to treat the poor with justice or to treat the poor with fairness? It does not mean, and I repeat, not underlined, it does not mean that you're required to make the poor rich immediately. It means that you're to treat their case with equity and justice. You are to do what you are obligated to do for them, being further up than they are on the social scale, does not give you liberties with them. It gives you responsibilities to them. Right? That's, again, the Christian mentality. If I'm a Christian master, the Bible gives me responsibilities to my servants, not liberties that I may take with my servants. Okay, now the fact that Solomon is not here arguing for a reversal of the social order, okay, this is something that I was talking about earlier, and then I'll make my other point. 24:32, I applied my heart to what I observed, and learned a lesson from what I saw. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man. Now, can you, through your own laziness, make yourself poor? Okay. If I, through my own laziness, make myself poor, should the king still be concerned about fairness for me? Yes. But fairness does not involve eliminating the poverty. Fairness involves something else. Justice involves something else. Back up to chapter 23, verse 21, verse 19. Listen, my son, and be wise, and keep your heart on the right path. Do not join those who drink too much wine or gorge themselves on meat, for drunkards and gluttons become poor, and drowsiness clothes them in rags. Okay, now, if I'm a king and a drunkard or a glutton comes up, or if I'm a magistrate and a drunkard or a glutton comes up before me on a charge of stealing something, do I look at him and say, well, he's obviously a wino that has got himself where he is, I don't have to listen to the evidence, throw him in the can? No. If I'm a just magistrate, I'm going to hear his case with fairness and with justice. But that fairness and justice does not mean eliminating the disparity in the social scale. You can't do that. Because as long as people are sinners, and as long as some people choose a certain type of sin, they will make themselves poor. If they choose drunkenness, if they choose gluttony, if they choose laziness, they will make themselves poor. They will set themselves up for oppression. Now, when they are oppressed, I judge their case with fairness. When they simply make themselves a slave, that is justice. All right? You follow what I'm saying? It is justice that if they squander all that they have, that they have no more. And then someone else has to take care of them. All right? And someone else that takes responsibility for them then receives a benefit from having to take care of them. All right? That's the essence of slavery. Now let's look over to Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes 10. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, the sort of error that arises from a ruler. Fools are put in many high positions, while the rich occupy the low ones. I have seen slaves on horseback, while princes go on foot like slaves. Now, what is that? When fools are in high positions and the rich are in low ones, when slaves are on horseback and princes are on foot, what is that? What does he call it? Verse 5. An evil. All right? It's not a good place to be. All right? Look down at verse 16. Now this, is, I think, really expresses a lot of principles together. Woe to you, O land, whose king was a servant, and whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of noble birth, and whose princes eat at a proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Okay, now, the point that he is making here is that a land that is ruled by people of low birth, or low upbringing, when they occupy a position of power, what do they do with it? What do the princes do?
Indulge.
They feast in the morning. Okay? Now, if someone is, if the land has a king of noble birth, what happens?
The land prospers.
The land prospers. But why do the princes eat?
For strength.
For strength, not for luxurious living. In other words, nobility in rulers is a good thing because it teaches the obligations that go with ruling. If someone of low position views that position of power as something that they can use to squeeze the people for all they can get. All right? Now this is a pattern that we've seen in our lifetimes in the continent of Africa. You know, periodically you hear about, well, so and so was a sergeant in the military. And then there was a coup, and this sergeant somehow comes out on top, all right? And you've got this person with no education and breeding and training to be a selfless ruler, taking the people for a ride, okay, via Idi Amin mentality. And that's why the scripture says, woe to you, O land, whose king was a servant. Because when they get there, they don't know what they're doing. They take the people for everything they can get. All right. Now, there is such a thing as a decadent aristocracy, a decadent period when the people of noble birth have no longer trained themselves to fulfill their responsibilities. But the best system is that system where the people who are running the show have been trained that their position gives them responsibility, not opportunity. All right? Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of noble birth and whose princes eat at a proper time for strength. They're not on the party circuit. Now, go to Washington, D.C. Why do they eat there? For strength? Or are they on the party circuit? Okay, it is very clear to me that our land is on the downhill slide because we do not expect sobriety and diligence from our rulers. Okay? Now, part of that is coming from our assertion that there's no difference between people. A servant is as good as, it doesn't matter who you are, any boy can become president. Now, any girl can become president. And that whole leveling thing, there are no distinctions, there are no differences. Servants, high birth, low birth, big deal, you know. But then the worst rises to the top, and then woe is you, O land. It's just not good. All right, now, yes.
But in the nation of Israel, it was founded, you know, they didn't have a separation. They were all pretty much the same. And it arose, but pretty much they were all treated on the same foot until they got, except for they had the priesthood.
They had the priesthood, and then you had those that Moses appointed as judges. It was pretty much a decentralized government. The most centralized aspect of it was the tabernacle system. One of the things I was just reading in Deuteronomy, one of the things that's interesting about what is told the king, let's see if I can find it, because it ties in with what we have in Ecclesiastes here. Well, I'm not going to hunt around for it. I'll just tell you what it is. It says the king is not to consider himself better than his brothers. It says you're not to, the king was not to accumulate gold and silver for himself. He was not to accumulate a lot of goodies for himself. He was to read the law, you know, write it out for himself and read it his whole life. And the king was not to consider himself better than his brothers. That is, he was to have the nobility of character that Solomon is talking about in Ecclesiastes, where he views his position as a position of service, not a position of taking the people for all you can get. All right. So I think your point is well taken. The early system of Israel, you did not have this vast disparity. You did have rulers and authorities, but the rulers and authorities were truly noble and they were truly an authority, but they were not living in a luxurious, ostentatious way, sort of like the French kings before all the Louis that were whooping it up at Versailles or whatever, wherever they were. That is not God's model for a governmental system. That is a gross oppression of the people that is going to cause an eruption, as we had in the French Revolution. Then servants become rulers, and then they don't do any better. they do far worse. So the monarchy before the revolution, they were living in luxury, and the people were having a hard time of it. But what happened was when the revolution came, they went from the frying pan to the fire. It was even worse when you had the servants come to the top, and they introduced the Reign of Terror. What this means is God's method of dealing with human problems is not our method of dealing with human problems. We say it isn't right. You know, but it's unjust. That's not good. It isn't right.
New government program.
What's that?
New government program.
New government program. Let's throw money at it. Let's do something. And what we attack the problem, and we make the problem that we're attacking invariably worse because we don't do it God's way. All right? Yes, God has got an opinion on all these things. Now, the thing, there's just no getting away from the fact, I think, that if I'd been around at the time of the Civil War and had been a careful student of the Scriptures, what I was being told to do by the Scriptures and what I was being told to do by the abolitionists would have been two entirely different things. Now, this is the difficulty, and this is how it applies to today. The spirit of abolitionism, which is the spirit of leveling, the spirit of saying everybody gets the same share. You redistribute the wealth, redistribute the power, give everybody the same share. That spirit is alive and well, and it's going on all around you. Okay, and you've got to identify the spirit, right, and resist it. For example, let me just do something. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and you can just take a mental quiz in your mind. Okay, and then I'm going to ask you to grade yourselves. All right? The United States government has, over the last few years, secretly backed a group of fighters called the Contras. In what country have we been doing that? I just mentally ask yourself. What country have we been backing Contras in? Okay. How many of you thought to yourselves, Nicaragua? Okay, about half. Okay, now, how many of you, if I gave a map of Central America, an unmarked map of Central America, how many of you could find El Salvador on it and Nicaragua on it? Okay, are you all going to vote in this coming election? Okay, now, what is the difference between an ABM and an ICBM? All right, anybody know the difference between an ABM and an ICBM? Anti-ballistic missile. ABM is a defensive weapon, ICBM is an offensive weapon. All right, now, what point am I making?
Do you know?
Okay, now, suppose you do what's being done. The Democratic Party has been registering voters in welfare lines. Okay, going down lines and registering people to vote. Now, the point that I'm making is, are our decisions, are the decisions of the electorate every 4 years, is it based on knowledge? Okay, now I did a little volunteer work for the Republican Party doing a phone survey, you know, asking people where they register to vote and who they're going to support in these various races. It's enough to destroy your faith in democracy, you know. Now, the dogma that everybody has an equal share of wisdom, the person in the welfare line who doesn't know Central America from Africa, okay, has got an equal voice with someone who has spent 3-4 years studying the whole issue, right? Now, that's the dogma, that they both have equal weight, right? I'll finish with this distinction. The utopian leveler says we want to, he laments the fact that we only have 50% turnout every election. That's dismal. We need to increase the voter registration. I'm personally really glad that those people aren't voting, because, you know. But they say, no, we got to have a higher turnout of voters. We got to have a higher turnout of voters, because he says the assumption is everybody's opinion is so valuable that we must seek it out before we can do anything. Now, I personally am glad that we've got the vote, and I'm personally glad that we have it spread out pretty thin. But the reason, I'm a reverse Democrat, a small D Democrat. I believe that it's good that we have it spread out, is because every person is so mixed up and so confused and sinful and self-centered that we want to spread the power as thinly as possible. Right? We want to have checks and balances in our governmental system. Don't give it all to the president. Don't give it all to the Supreme Court. Don't give it all to the Congress. Don't give it all to the government. Give some to the state governments. Give some to the people. You know, put as much power in all these different places as you can to keep any one group from getting a hold of it all. All right? Now, that view of democracy springs from a low view of man. The other springs from a utopian high view of man. The utopian high view of man that says everybody can do the same thing, everybody is equal, everybody should all be the same, that is the spirit that animated abolitionism, and it's still with us, and it animates things like feminism, and it animates all sorts of movements today, and we could have dealt with it 100 years ago and more, but we didn't, and so we're sort of living with the results of it.
But the reason that Lincoln went to war wasn't to abolish slavery, but to preserve the Union based on the Constitution.
Exactly. Lincoln was not an abolitionist. He was, the Emancipation Proclamation was not made until 1863, you know, well into the war, like 3 years into the war, when I think it was after or right around the Battle of Vicksburg. You know, the war was well on its way. Lincoln freed the slaves.
And only in the South.
And only in the only slaves that were freed were the slaves that were in the states that were fighting the Union. And Lincoln did that under pressure from abolitionists. In other words, Lincoln's concern was a political one, not a, he was not an abolitionist. and all the political issues are complex, but just suffice it to say, the spirit of abolitionism, the spirit of leveling, was an anti-Christian spirit. Christians should resist it today, and they should recognize when it began. It didn't show up in the early 70s. You know, it's been with us for hundreds of years. All right? Well, let's thank the Lord. Father in heaven, we're grateful to you for all your good gifts to us. I pray that you'd be with us as we chew on these things and meditate on them. In Jesus' name, amen.